Chapter 10. The way sadness works is one of the strange riddles of the world. If you are stricken with a great sadness, you may feel as if you have been set aflame, not only because of the enormous pain, but also because your sadness may spread over your life like smoke from an enormous fire. You might find it difficult to see anything but your own sadness, the way smoke can cover a landscape so that all anyone can see is black. You may find that happy things are tainted with sadness, the way smoke leaves its ashen colors and scents on everything it touches. And you may find that if someone pours water all over you, you are damp and distracted, but not cured of your sadness, the way a fire department can douse a fire but never recover what has been burnt down. The Baudelaire orphans, of course, had had a great sadness in their life from the moment they first heard of their parents' death, and sometimes it felt as if they had to wave smoke away from their eyes to see even the happiest of moments. As Violet and Klaus watched Fiona and the hook-handed man embrace one another, they felt as if the smoke of their own unhappiness had filled the brig. They could not bear to think that Fiona had found her long-lost brother, when they themselves, in all likelihood, would never see their parents again, and might even lose their sister, as the poisonous spores of the medusoid mycelium made her coughing sound worse and worse inside the helmet.
"Fiona," the hook-handed man cried, "is it really you?"
"Aye,"
the mycologist said, taking off her triangular glasses to wipe away her tears.
"I never thought I would see you again, Fernald. What happened to your hands?"
"Never mind that," the hook-handed man said quickly. "Why are you here?
Did you join Count Olaf too?"
"Certainly not," Fiona said firmly. "He captured the Queequeg and threw us into the brig."
"So you've joined the Baudelaire brats," the hook-handed man said. "I should have known you were a goody-goody."
"I haven't joined the Baudelaires," Fiona said just as firmly. "They've joined me. I'm the captain of the Queequeg now."
"You?" said Olaf's henchman. "What happened to Withershins?"
"He disappeared from the submarine," Fiona replied. "We don't know where he is."
"I don't care where he is," the hook-handed man sneered. "I couldn't care less about that mustached fool. He's the reason I joined Count Olaf in the first place. The captain was always shouting, 'Aye, aye, aye,' and ordering me around, so I ran away and joined Olaf's acting troop."
"But Count Olaf is a terrible villain," Fiona cried. "He has no regard for other people. He dreams up treacherous schemes and lures others into becoming his cohorts."
"Well, those are just the bad aspects of him," the hook-handed man said. "There are many good parts as well. For instance, he has a wonderful laugh."
"A wonderful laugh is no excuse for villainous behaviour," Fiona said.
"Let's just agree to disagree," the hook-handed man replied,
using a tiresome expression which here means, "You're probably right, but I'm too embarrassed to admit it." He waved one hook carelessly at his sister.
"Step aside, Fiona. It's time for the orphans to tell me where the sugar bowl is."
Olaf's henchman scraped his hooks together to give them a quick sharpening and took one threatening step toward the Baudelaires. Violet and Klaus looked at one another in fear, and then at the diving helmet, where they heard their sister give another shuddering cough, and knew that it was time to lay their cards on the table, a phrase which here means reveal themselves honestly to Olaf's wicked henchmen.
"We don't know where the sugar bowl is," Violet said. "My sister is telling the truth," Klaus said. "Do with us what you will, but we won't be able to tell you anything."
The hook-handed man glared at them
and scraped his hooks together once more. "You're liars," he said. "Both of you are rotten, orphan liars."
"It's true, Fernald," Fiona said. "Aye. Finding the sugar bowl was the Queequeg's mission, but so far we've failed."
"If you don't know where the sugar bowl is," the hook-handed man said angrily, "then putting you in the brig is completely pointless."
He turned around and kicked his small stool, toppling it over, and then kicked the wall of the brig for good measure.
"What am I supposed to do now?" he sulked.
Fiona put her hand on her brother's hook.
"Take us back to the Queequeg," she said. "Sunny is in that helmet, along with a growth of medusoid mycelium."
"Medusoid mycelium?"
Olaf's henchman repeated in horror.
"That's a very dangerous fungus."
"She's in great danger," Violet said. "If we don't find a cure very, very soon, she'll die."
The hook-handed man frowned, but then looked at the helmet and gave the children a shrug.
"Why should I care if she dies?" he asked. "She's made my life miserable from the time I met her. Every time we fail to get the Baudelaire fortune, Count Olaf yells at everyone."
"You're the one who made the Baudelaire's lives miserable," Fiona said. "Count Olaf has performed countless treacherous schemes, and you helped him time and time again. Aye, you ought to be ashamed of yourself."
The hook-handed man sighed and looked down at the floor of the brig.
"Sometimes I am," he admitted. "Life in Olaf's troop sounded like it was going to be glamorous and fun, but we've ended up doing more murder, arson, blackmail and assorted violence than I would have preferred."
"This is your chance to do something noble," Fiona said. "You don't have to remain on the wrong side of the schism."
"Oh, Fiona,"
the hook-handed man said, and put one hook awkwardly around her shoulder.
"You don't understand. There is no wrong side of the schism."
"Of course there is," Klaus said. "VFD is a noble organization, and Count Olaf is a terrible villain."
"A noble organization?" the hook-handed man said. "Is that so? Tell that to your baby sister, you four-eyed fool. If it weren't for volatile fungus deportation, you never would have encountered those deadly mushrooms."
The children looked at one another, remembering what they had read in the Gorgonian grotto. They had to admit that Olaf's henchman was right. But Violet reached into her pocket and drew out the newspaper clipping Sunny had found in the cave. She held it out so everyone could see the Daily Punctilio article that the eldest Baudelaire had kept hidden for so long.
"Verifying Fernald's defection," she said, reading the headline out loud, and then continued by reading the byline, a word which here means name of the person who wrote the article. "By Jacques Snicket. It has now been confirmed that the fire that destroyed Anne Whistle Aquatics and took the life of famed ichnologist Gregor Anne Whistle was set by Fernald Widdershins, the son of the captain of the Queequeg submarine. The Widdershins family's participation in a recent schism has raised several questions regarding..."
Violet looked up and met the glare of Olaf's henchman.
"The rest of the article is blurry," she said. "But the truth is clear. You defected. You abandoned VFD and joined up with Olaf."
"The difference between the two sides of the schism," Klaus said, "is that one side puts out fires and the other starts them."
The hook-handed man reached forward and speared the article on one of his hooks and then turned the clipping around so he could read it again.
"You should have seen the fire," he said quietly. "From a distance, it looked like an enormous black plume of smoke rising straight out of the water. It was like the entire sea was burning down."
"You must have been proud of your handiwork," Fiona said bitterly.
"Proud?" the hook-handed man said. "It was the worst day of my life. That plume of smoke was the saddest thing I ever saw."
He speared the newspaper with his other hook and ripped the article into shreds. "The punctilio got everything wrong," he said. "Captain Widdershins isn't my father. Widdershins isn't my last name, and there's much more to the fire than that. You should know that the Daily Punctilio doesn't tell the whole story, Baudelaire's, just as the poison of a deadly fungus can be the source of some wonderful medicines. Someone like Jacques Snicket can do something villainous, and someone like Count Olaf can do something noble. Even your parents—"
"Our stepfather knew Jacques Snicket," Fiona said. "He was a good man, but Count Olaf murdered him." "Are you a murderer too? Did you kill Gregor Anwissel?"
In grim silence, the hook-handed man held his hooks in front of the children.
"The last time you saw me," he said to Fiona, "I had two hands instead of hooks. Our stepfather probably didn't tell you what happened to me. He always said there were secrets in the world too terrible for young people to know. What a fool."
"Our stepfather isn't a fool," Fiona said. "He's a noble man.
People aren't either wicked or noble," the hook-handed man said. "They're like chef salads, with good things and bad things chopped and mixed together in a vinaigrette of confusion and conflict."
He turned to the two elder Baudelaires and pointed at them with his hooks.
"Look at yourselves, Baudelaires. Do you really think we're so different? When those eagles carried me away from the mountains in that net, I saw the ruins of that fire in the hinterlands, a fire we started together. You've burned things down, and so have I. You joined the crew of the Queequeg, and I joined the crew of the Carmelita. Our captains are both volatile people, and we're both trying to get to the Hotel Denouement before Thursday. The only difference between us is the portraits on our uniforms."
"We're wearing Herman Melville," Klaus said. "He was a writer of enormous talent who dramatized the plight of overlooked people, such as poor sailors or exploited youngsters, through his strange, often experimental, philosophical prose. I'm proud to display his portrait. But you're wearing Edgar Guest. He was a writer of limited skill who wrote awkward, tedious poetry on hopelessly sentimental topics. You ought to be ashamed of yourself."
"Edgar Guest isn't my favourite poet," the hook-handed man admitted. "Before I joined up with Count Olaf, I was studying poetry with my stepfather. We used to read to one another in the main hall of the Queequeg. But it's too late now. I can't return to my old life."
"Maybe not," Klaus said. "But you can return us to the Queequeg, so we can save Sonny."
"Please,"
the children heard Sonny say from inside the helmet, although her voice was quite hoarse, as if she would not be able to speak for much longer. And for a moment the only sound in the brig was Sonny's desperate coughing as the minutes in her crucial hour ticked away, and the muttering of the hook-handed man as he paced back and forth, twiddling his hooks in thought. Violet and Klaus watched his hooks, and thought of all the times he had used them to threaten the siblings. It is one thing to believe that people have both good and bad inside them, mixed together like ingredients in a salad bowl, but it is quite another to look at a cohort of a despicable villain who has tried again and again to cause so much harm and try to see where the good parts are buried, when all you can remember is the pain and suffering he has caused. As the hook-handed man circled the brig, it was as if the Baudelaires were picking through a chef's salad, consisting mostly of dreadful and perhaps even poisonous ingredients, trying desperately to find the one noble crouton that might save their sister. Just as I, between paragraphs, am picking through this salad in front of me, hoping that my waiter is more noble than wicked, and that my sister Kit might be saved by the small herbed piece of toast I hope to retrieve from my bowl. After much hemming and hawing, however, a phrase which here means muttering and clearing of one's throat, used to avoid making a quick decision,
Count Olaf's henchman stopped in front of the children, put his hooks on his hips, and offered them a Hobson's choice.
"I'll return you to the Queequeg," he said, "if you take me with you."